What a treat it is tonight just to see the names of these wonderful public media spaces for the first time all together. Well, here, of course, the Lensic, the performing arts center that is truly a sanctuary of dissent. And it is such a great honor to have come back here over and over. I also want to honor the Lannan Foundation, Patrick and Andy and Barbara and Lori and all the folks who, they were the first ones to bring us out here, and the first event took place right here at the Lensic. So it is so close to my heart. And to see New Mexico PBS, what you know as KNME, KSFR right here in Santa Fe, and KUNM, New Mexico Public Radio. It is so beautiful for all of these public spaces to be together. I mean, that is our goal at Democracy Now!, is to go around the country and bring together all of the public media spaces. We also broadcast, and I hope everyone has gotten these flyers. When you go out, you can take a bunch. You can take piles of them, bring them to coffee shops and laundromats and schools and galleries, and let people know where they can get Democracy Now!, this daily, grassroots, global, unembedded, independent, international, investigative news hour. I also, and among the places that we broadcast just in New Mexico, Santa Fe Community Television Channel 16 every day, also at 9 to 4, bringing together public access TV, PBS, increasingly all over the country, NPR stations, Pacifica stations, community and college radio stations. We have to expand the public spaces. As Comcast is gobbling up or hoping to merge with Time Warner after already doing it with NBC Universal, for just one example, as they consolidate the corporate media, we have to expand the public media, because in public media, that's where we can have the genuine conversations that are so vital. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day: war and peace, life and death, and anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. You know, last night I was speaking at the Klein Library at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. And as we were walking over to the talk, Rotzi was outside, and the young soldiers-to-be were all working out in the big green of NAU. And this is a critical point. If we don't have these discussions, they can't. You know, the servicemen and women of this country can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, whether they are sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. We have just recently returned from Tokyo, Japan. We broadcast for 3 days from Tokyo. And one of the last interviews we did while there, we saved until this week, because this week is the third anniversary of Fukushima, of the triple catastrophe that Japan faced on March 11, 2011, when the great Japan earthquake led to a tsunami that led to the meltdown of 3 reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi plants. The people of Japan are still reeling. There are hundreds of thousands of nuclear refugees, people who've been displaced from their homes in Japan. This week, we brought you the interview with Naoto Kan, the former prime minister, the one who was in office when Fukushima meltdown occurred. He is one of the few world leaders, sitting world leaders, who changed his mind completely while in office. We sat down in his offices just last month, and I asked him to describe that day, March 11th. He was a huge supporter of nuclear power. He was part of the so-called, what they call it in Japan, the nuclear village. It's the nuclear power corporations that run so much of Japan. Already, Japan's at 30% reliance on nuclear power, and they were hoping to move to 50%. So March 11th, the catastrophe takes place, and he hears about the beginning of the possibility of a meltdown. And he was part of the nuclear village. His friends, his allies, his colleagues were, for example, the leaders of TEPCO. That's the Tokyo Electric the Tokyo Electric Power Company that ran the Fukushima Daiichi plant. So he immediately turned to them, okay, what's happening? And he realized he could not get a straight answer. He realized he was being spun. They gave him the former vice president of TEPCO to be at his side, to help him make decisions. And he said, nothing that came out of his mouth was true. These were the people that he had allied with for years. And he decided the only way he could get an accurate sense of what would happen, he was trying to decide if he would have to evacuate 50 million people, the entire city of Tokyo. He said he had to figure out if Japan was ending as we knew it. And so early in the morning, he flew to the nuclear plant. He thought his best bet would be to speak to the workers on the ground. They would not be political. They would be there desperately trying to save these plants, and in so doing, save Japan. And he said he finally got the answers he needed. And the biggest answer of all, he said, was that nuclear power is not viable in Japan or anywhere in the world. He said the risk is simply too great. And he turned from being a nuclear proponent to be a leading voice against nuclear power in the world today. He will travel anywhere to speak out against nuclear power. It always amazes me that some of the most conservative forces in this country are pushing nuclear power. Also, it's not just Republicans, it's Democrats as well. President Obama has embraced nuclear power. He's done something that President Bush did not dare do. The Obama administration is pushing forward with the building of two new nuclear plants in Georgia for the first time in almost 40 years. And it's also the case in Japan that the current, the most conservative administration of Japan since World War II, Shinzo Abe, is pushing to open new nuclear plants as the country is overwhelmingly in Japan opposed to nuclear power. And you have the same situation with the media here as the media there. You know, 90% of life is just showing up just for us going to Japan. If you watch the media, you would have the sense that the country was divided, but probably more likely more nuclear. But on the ground, I mean, just in the few days we were there, we went to the official residence of the prime minister. There were hundreds of people protesting against nuclear power, and this happens every single week there. And the polls show overwhelmingly the people of Japan are opposed to nuclear power. So here you have Naoto Kan saying, we can't afford this. And you look at this country, the extolling of free enterprise, people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, businesses being able to just operate freely in a capitalist society, but nuclear power is precisely the opposite. It cannot function in a free enterprise capitalist system because no insurance company would insure the possibility of this catastrophe. And so it's your tax dollars that go to insure this, that make the loan guarantees. And as you know, we have not resolved since the beginning the problem of nuclear waste. And you know it well from the WIPP facility here in New Mexico. It's very difficult to get any accurate information about what just recently happened. And I think it may have something to do with the fact that the government wants to expand the WIPP facility to be a major site for nuclear waste in the United States. And it's not very convenient to not be able to explain what this radioactive plume and release was about and how many people were actually injured as a result of it. I mean, as we flew in today from Phoenix to Albuquerque, I once again thought about that quip someone made, that if New Mexico were to secede from the United States, it would be the third largest nuclear power in the world. United States, Russia, and then New Mexico itself. But this is the birthplace of the atomic age. This is where the nuclear age dawned, not far from here at Los Alamos. And the Trinity test in Alamogordo. So here in New Mexico, you have a tremendous responsibility to decide where this country should go. And being in Japan, that country has been bookended by these nuclear catastrophes. Most recently, the meltdown, which continues to threaten Japan, and not just Japan, make no mistake about it. You know, radioactivity doesn't just get contained among borders that politicians decide. We are affected here as well. But that's this end of the era of nuclear power and weapons so far. They were the target of the dawn of the nuclear age here in New Mexico, with the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We couldn't go to Japan for the first time without visiting Hiroshima. We took a train to Hiroshima, the bullet train, and a hibakusha took us around. Hibakusha is Japanese for an atomic bomb survivor. He was 87 years old. His 13-year-old sister died in the bombing. He barely survived. And we were walking to the Hiroshima Peace Museum, and he said, "Stop right here on the plaza." I said, "You don't want to go into the museum?" He said, "No, I want you to stop right here." He said, "People lived here. People lived here." And then he said, "We could go inside." The story of the dawn of the nuclear age is also the story of the original embedded reporter and the original independent reporter. I want to tell you the story of two men. Wilfred Burchett was an Australian journalist who, despite General MacArthur's orders that no journalist should go into southern Japan after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so most of the journalists obediently went to the USS Missouri off the coast of Japan to cover the surrender of the Japanese. Instead, Wilfred Burchett got on a train and he traveled for 30 hours to Hiroshima. When he got out in Hiroshima, he could not believe his eyes. He saw a city that had become a moonscape. He said, "Hiroshima does not look like a bomb city. It looks as if a monster steamroller has passed over it and squashed it out of existence." And he saw something else that he couldn't explain. He didn't have the words for it. He saw that people were dying, not of the initial bomb blast, but of something else. He didn't know about radiation. He called it a bomb sickness, that people had hemorrhages under their skin, that their hair was falling out, and they were dying weeks later. He sat down in the rubble with his Hermes typewriter, and he tapped out the words, "I write this as a warning to the world." The piece appeared in the beginning of September in the London Express, and it rocked the U.S. administration, the War Department, Major General Leslie Groves, who headed up the Manhattan Project here in Los Alamos in New Mexico. They had to counter what he said. They called his reporting Japanese propaganda. But it wasn't just the general that called it this. He knew he had to get reporters writing this. So he called reporters to New Mexico, and he brought them to the Trinity site, to the original test site, to prove that radiation was not a problem. In fact, their driver, who took them there and drove Major Groves there, a young soldier, stood in the middle of the crater. He would later die of leukemia. Among the people, the reporters he brought to New Mexico to counter Wilfrid Burchett's claims, was one William Lawrence, the premier science reporter in the United States, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. And it was not only General Groves that talked about the Japanese propaganda. He had a dutiful scribe. He had his New York Times reporter, William Lawrence. In fact, William Lawrence was in the squadron of planes that dropped the second bomb, the plutonium bomb, on Nagasaki. Some called him Atomic Bill for his reverence of atomic power. And you think about the difference between what Wilfrid Burchett wrote and what William Lawrence wrote. His article about the bombing of Nagasaki was withheld by military censors until a month after the bombing. He described the detonation over Nagasaki that incinerated 100,000 people. Said Lawrence, awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the Earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being born right before our incredulous eyes. He would later recount his impressions of the atomic bomb, saying, being close to it and watching it as it was being fashioned into a living thing so exquisitely shaped that any sculptor would be proud to have created it, one felt oneself in the presence of the supernatural. He wrote a series of 10 articles for the New York Times and won a second Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. What wasn't known then was that in March of 1945, just a couple of months before the dropping of the bombs, Leslie Groves made a secret visit to New York, to the New York Times, to meet with William Lawrence and offer him a job that William Lawrence proudly took. And that was to write the press releases for President Truman and Secretary of War Stimson. He was on the payroll of the War Department, as it was called at the time, and he was on the payroll of the New York Times. My brother David and I, a wonderful journalist from Vermont, we wrote our first book, The Exception to the Rulers, and that shouldn't just be the motto of Democracy Now!, it should be the motto of all the media, The Exception to the Rulers. That is our job. You know, there's a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. And in it, we have a chapter on these two reporters. And we, a few years ago, went up to Columbia University. I was actually just there two nights ago speaking, but we went a few years ago to give a petition to the Pulitzer Committee, which is housed at the Columbia Journalism School, calling for William Lawrence to be stripped posthumously of that Pulitzer, as well as the New York Times. Because I think the embedding process has brought the media to an all-time low. William Lawrence was the original embedded reporter. But you look at the reporters embedded in troops in Iraq and now Afghanistan, I am not saying they're not brave. They are. But it was the Pentagon that crafted this as a solution to, you know, the images coming out of Vietnam, sort of like if you can't beat them, join them. Have the reporters join the soldiers. Now, what perspective do you think you're going to get in these articles? If the reporter is sleeping with the troops, eating with the troops, his life or her life is in their hands. If you're going to have embedded reporters, embedded with the military, you need reporters embedded in Iraqi hospitals and Afghan communities, in the peace movement around the world to convey the full effects of war. The Pentagon has called the embedding process a spectacular success, which is why it is a complete failure. It is not our job to amplify the state, but to challenge those in power. Our second book, Static, we called it Static because in this high-tech digital age, with high-definition television and digital radio, still all we ever get is static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality, when what we need the media to give us is the dictionary definition of static, criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. A little side note that I think is also very instructive when it comes to the role of media. You know, it wasn't a foregone conclusion what cities in Japan would be destroyed, what cities the U.S. military would drop the uranium and then the plutonium bomb on. Secretary of War was handed a list of Japanese cities: Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kyoto. He immediately crossed Kyoto off the list. Why? Because he and Mrs. Stimson had visited Kyoto. The food was delicious. The people were wonderful. The temples magnificent. He said, "I know this city. I don't want to destroy it." If only the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been lucky enough to host the Stimsons. But think about how profound his point is. He had come to know this place, and that is the role of the media. I mean, how do we learn about the rest of the world? Either we have family or friends who come from other places, or we visited them ourselves, but most often we learn about the rest of the world through the media. And the rest of the world learns about us through the media, and it has to be something through something other than a corporate lens and a corporate microphone. And when we come to know another place, I mean, that is the power of independent media. It allows people to speak for themselves. When you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it's a woman in a wedding convoy in Yemen whose family is blown up by a U.S. drone, or an uncle in Afghanistan who undergoes some kind of night raid and loses his brother and his son. When you hear them speaking, it challenges the stereotypes and caricatures that fuel the hate groups. You may not agree with what you hear. I mean, how often do we even agree with our family members? But you begin to understand where someone is coming from. You begin to find common ground. That is the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, it is wielded as a weapon of war. We have to take it back. There is so much to talk about over the last few years because, I mean, just talking about 2011, what a year of movements. And that is why we need an independent media. We need a media that covers those movements, that gives voice to those movements, not the small circle of pundits that you get on all the networks. Those networks that, well, they seem to proliferate, but in fact, they are owned by fewer and fewer corporations. And yet the same small group, it's like a traveling circus of pundits you see on all these networks. These pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We need to go deeply, as Dave was just talking about with KSFR, into the communities to find the experts in our own communities, as KUNM does, as New Mexico Public Television does. The public spaces that bring the public in. People who are experts in their own lives, giving legitimacy to their experience. This is the importance of media. Now, I originally come from Pacifica Radio, and I know many of you have heard me tell the story of Pacifica, but it is so relevant here, parallel to what I'm talking about. You know, Pacifica, born in 1949 in Berkeley, California, a war resistor named Lou Hill comes out of the detention camps and says, there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And so Pacifica was born, the first station, KPFA, in Berkeley in 1949. As George Gerbner, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, would say, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. So the first station, KPFA in Berkeley, the second one, KPFK in Los Angeles, 1959, 10 years later, 1960, my station in New York, WBAI, 1977, WPFW in Washington, 1970, KPFT in Houston. That's the five Pacifica stations. KPFT, 1970, went on the air. It's the only radio station in the country. You know, it's in the Petro Metro of Houston, Texas. It's the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up. The Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. Now, it's not as if Pacifica had money for advertising their new station, so it's certainly that if there was a silver lining, blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of the people of Houston. So when they got back on their feet a few months later and they rebuilt the transmitter and they went on the air, they were in the middle of playing Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant, and the Klan blew it up again. Now, I don't remember if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles, but he said it was his proudest act. I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it simply allows people to speak for themselves, which makes it much less likely to target them. When Pacifica rebuilt the transmitter again, now this was a national event when they went back on the air, and I just saw Arlo Guthrie in New York as we celebrated the life of Pete Seeger. And Arlo remembered well when he was invited back to Houston to the studios of KPFT when they went back on the air for the third time. PBS broadcast this event nationwide as KPFT went back on the air and Arlo Guthrie finished Alice's Restaurant. But 2011, the year of movements, you know, you have the Egyptian uprising that takes place. And you know the reporting that Democracy Now! Did, thanks to our senior producer, Sharif Abdelkaddous, who left Democracy Now! At that time, a senior producer in New York, and flew home to cover what was happening in his home country, something he could hardly fathom having lived under Mubarak for so many years. He was accompanied by our chief videographer, Hani Massoud, also Egyptian-American, who leaps tall buildings in a single bound. If you're anywhere dangerous, you want Hani, who played also on the Egyptian basketball team, the Egyptian national basketball team. You want Hani at your side with that video camera. I remember being at the Republican convention the first day in 2008 after the Democrats in Denver, you know, there were major protests taking place, and we came from the airport just as we were arriving in St. Paul, and we were told that a house was being raided by the police, and we raced to this house, and I immediately jumped over the fence in the backyard to speak to the people who were handcuffed in the backyard. The police told me to get away. I asked who is the homeowner, because I knew the police would respect private property. And he said, it's me. I said, do I have permission to step on your property? And he said, of course. The police were a bit confused, but when Hani jumped over the fence after me, and started filming, the police moved in on him fast. And he turned to them and he said, "Please, she's going to fire me if I don't follow her." He said, "You know what it means to have a boss?" They let him go. Anyway. But what these movements meant, I mean, Sharif's reporting, just like many of you, I'm sure, just waited breathlessly to get those reports from Tahrir. He basically lived at Tahrir those first 18 days before Mubarak fell. And it was astounding to see, you know, we're celebrating our 18th birthday at Democracy Now!, which is incredibly thrilling. We began in 1996 as the only daily election show in public broadcasting. I think we were broadcasting on 8 community radio stations at the time. And then September 11th happened, and just coincidentally that week, we went on our first TV station, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, public access TV in New York City, because it had a direct video link to the old firehouse, which had been turned into a community media center that we were broadcasting from, which happened to be right next to Ground Zero. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero on September 11th. We went on as emergency broadcasting. Soon, public access stations around the country asked if we could send video cassettes of our daily show to them. I thought we had to FedEx it because it was breaking news after all, and soon the FedEx guys were picking up garbage bags filled with video cassettes. And when we went on a TV station into town, the NPR station would call and say, "Could we get that show?" Or the community station or the college station, and then the PBS station would ask. And so now, after 18 years, we are the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 1,200 public radio and television stations around the world. And I dare say that part of the growth is people's hunger for independent voices, is the kind of work that people like Sharif Abdelkaddous and Hani Massoud did in the streets in Tahrir. As they brought you, now this is how it worked at the beginning. Remember, Mubarak brought down the internet. He did it with a U.S. company named Naris. He couldn't have done it by himself, but they pushed the button. And, you know, when there was global outcry, how can you take down the internet? And Naris put out a press release saying, "We were only following orders." We have heard that before. So he takes down the internet. And Sharif joked. He said, you know, we're Egyptian after all. He said, we would have all been inside just being on Facebook. But once he took down the internet, we had to go outside. We had to have somewhere to go. And so we gathered at Tahrir. Anyway, you have a million people in Tahrir. The internet is down. But Hani and Sharif figure out a way around the internet blockade, and Sharif becomes one of the top tweeters in the world describing what's happening. Then Mubarak allowed the internet to go back up, but the thugs broke up the satellites. That's what the networks use. The networks use satellite. At the beginning, we couldn't afford that, and so we perfected a way to send broadcast quality video over the internet. And that is also, by the way, why we have to keep the internet open and free, open access for everyone, why we have to preserve network neutrality. We have to be able to communicate with each other. You know, it was developed with public resources, and now that the internet is so incredibly valuable, and corporations have been globalizing for a long time, but internet allows us to grassroots globalize, communicate with people all over the world. But now that it's so valuable, the telecoms and the video companies want to write the legislation that would privatize the internet, make it a two-tiered highway or even more tiers. So if you go to google.com, it'll come right up. democracynow.org might take you about 15 minutes. And a Dalit women's website in India, you might not ever be able to access at all. That is unacceptable. We have to fight for an open and free internet. But, so, when the satellites, the thugs... When the thugs brought down the satellites, and we use satellite now also, but we certainly had a way to do it another way. We could use the internet. Sharif would be interviewing people in Tahrir, so that it wouldn't just be that bird's eye view you got from the networks, which was totally stunning of all of the people in Tahrir. But you'd meet Nawal al-Sadawi, the 79-year-old former presidential candidate. She'd been arrested under Sadat. She had been exiled under Mubarak. She was a writer and a psychiatrist, and she'd been holding salons before the uprising, telling young people, "We will win, we will win." You met Hadass Sawef, the great Egyptian writer who wrote Map of Love, talking about her experience in Tahrir. When Mubarak fell, she was with some very pregnant women, and she said now they could give birth to their babies in freedom. You met the young girl, a high school student who stood in the shadow of the state media building that had spewed lies for so long, and she's putting out a broadsheet, Voices of Tahrir, throughout Tahrir. These could be members of your family, and they were a much larger family. Where this revolution goes, we don't know at this point. But who you got to meet there because of Sharif speaking to all of these people, and though the satellites were down, and you saw people like Anderson Cooper in their hotel room, their lower third, saying, reporting from an undisclosed location. They look like old Democracy Now through Skype because they didn't have the satellites. There was Sharif standing tall in Tahrir, saying his name, saying, I'm right here in Tahrir, the safest place to be in all of Egypt. And as he would do these interviews, Hani would race back to his house. He would put together the interviews, and then he would send them through the internet, and we would broadcast those 20, 25-minute reports, and you would understand who was fomenting a revolution in Egypt. That is why I think Democracy Now! Has grown to the point it has. It is the people on the ground expressing their goals, their aspirations. Sometimes they win, and sometimes they are crushed, but at least you get to hear them in real time. You have the Egyptian Revolution, and then that inspires partly, I do believe, what happened in Wisconsin, this remarkable uprising. Wisconsin had never seen the likes of it. 150,000 people marching in Madison, Wisconsin, in the Capitol. I mean, when Democracy Now! Flew into Madison, it was just astounding to see people across the political spectrum. This was not Democrats rising up against the Republican Governor Walker. This was the older gentleman who I interviewed stomping through the snow with a sign, white hair, glasses, carrying a sign that said, IRS agents against Walker. I asked him if he was a Democrat or a Republican, and he said, a Republican, of course. And I said, who did you vote for? And he said, Governor Walker, of course. He said, but I didn't vote for him to eviscerate labor rights in our state. And then being at the Capitol overnight, where teachers and police and firefighters and nurses and the prison guards in Oshkosh all slept together, occupying the Capitol. I have never seen such large men in my life as the prison guards of Oshkosh. And I went up to them and I said, who did you vote for? And they said, Governor Walker, of course. I said, what are you doing here? And they said, protecting the nurses and the teachers. And I asked the police, they were very different from the police in New York at Occupy Wall Street. I said, what are you doing here sleeping next to the nurses and the teachers? You know, not holding guns there. Because Governor Walker assured the firefighters and the police that he would not go after their unions, that they were essential services. And they said, we aren't fooled. He may not go after us now, but what about when the teachers and the nurses are no longer protected? Who does he go after next? I mean, to see in front of the governor's office in the Capitol, to see the kids with their dreads beating on those plastic drums and the police rocking out next to them, it was an incredible sight. And for those who think, yeah, but these are nothing like the past protests, you know, of the civil rights movement and the abolition movement, really think again. As I went up in one of those cranes to get that bird's eye view of what was happening in Wisconsin and Madison, the largest protests in the coldest weather that Wisconsin had ever seen, I see the Labor History Museum across the street. You know that Wisconsin was the home of AFSCME, born in 1932, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. It has all different divergent tendencies in Wisconsin. Also in that same year, was established the John Birch Society, and it was founded by the father of the Koch brothers, Fred Koch. So it's very interesting to see what's going on in Wisconsin. But AFSCME, think about this, and the threat that people felt now as a result of the going after the organizing rights of labor unions. Just go back to Dr. King. When he died, when he was assassinated, April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee, what was he doing there? He was marching with local sanitation workers who were simply trying to organize Local 1707 of AFSCME. Yes, there is a continuum here. And from Wisconsin, to the pizzerias were thriving. People in Egypt were calling the Madison, Wisconsin pizzerias to order pizza for the protesters. And then let's move forward. Let's move forward to August, September of 2011 and what happened around the White House. 1,200 people, the largest environmental civil disobedience took place. There were thousands, but 1,200 got arrested, forming a ring around the White House, protesting President Obama possibly signing off on the Keystone XL pipeline. That was the summer of 2011. Just a few weeks later, some of those people would make their way to New York, and joining thousands of others, people marched on Zuccotti Park. And that was the beginning of the Occupy movement. Now, that was an astounding moment. And yes, people in Egypt and Madison, Wisconsin were calling in orders to the local pizzerias in the Wall Street area to make sure that the occupiers were fed. And it was amazing to see thousands of people set up their encampments. And they had so much pizza and so much food from local gardens that they had these huge lunch lines where people from all over would come. And you would often see business leaders in their three-piece suits online. You know, they more than any appreciated a free lunch. And the protesters use every aspect of the pizzas. They would use the boxes to make signs. I remember in October there was this freak snowstorm, and they cleared up all the signs, and they left one as they all went under the tarps, and it said, "Hell snow, we won't go." But there were other signs that people carried into Occupy Wall Street that September 17th, 2011. And they were the signs that said, "I am Troy Davis," and "Too much doubt." Hundreds of people were protesting the imminent execution of yet another African-American prisoner, this one in Jackson, Georgia. After the Zuccotti Park uprising of September 17th, we flew down to Georgia. We didn't know what would happen. In fact, Troy had gotten three death warrants vacated. So who knew what would happen? On September 21st at 7 p.m., Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. I was reporting live from outside Georgia's death row prison in Jackson, awaiting news about whether the Supreme Court would spare his life. Davis was sentenced to death for the murder of off-duty Savannah police officer Mark McPhail in 1989. Seven of the nine non-police witnesses later recanted or changed their testimony, some alleging police intimidation for their original false statements. One who didn't recant was the man who many named as the actual killer. No physical evidence linked Davis to the shooting. Davis was one of more than 3,200 people on death row in the United States. He'd faced three prior execution dates. With each one, global awareness grew. Amnesty International took up his case. The NAACP did. Calls for clemency came from the Pope, from former FBI Director William Sessions, from former Republican Georgia Congressmember Bob Barr, the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles, in granting a stay of execution in 2007, wrote it will not allow an execution to proceed in the state unless there's no doubt as to the guilt of the accused. But it was just that doubt that galvanized so much global outrage. As we waited, and this was very interesting, to go to the death row prison. Most people in the country don't realize we're the only industrialized country in the world to have the death penalty. But we went to Jackson, Georgia, and we went to cover the protest. We did not know what had happened. We would start our broadcast at 6 in the evening. Troy Davis was scheduled to die at 7, and we would just take it through the night. We didn't even have a regularly scheduled broadcast. We just let people know we'd start broadcasting. So we went to the prison grounds. There was a protest pen set up for 150 protesters. All the others, 1,000 people, would have to remain outside the grounds. You know, students from Spelman and Morehouse, the historically black colleges in Georgia and Atlanta, had come to Jackson. All were holding candles. People had come from around the world. But so as we were on the grounds of the prison, we wanted to set up right at the protest pen. But the prison guard said we could go nowhere near it. We had to be on the periphery. And I looked over, and there were satellite trucks of all the networks. And I said, they're not arguing. I mean, we were going to do a many hours broadcast. I wasn't going to talk all of this time. We had come to speak to the people who would be vigiling there. Why would they come from all over the world? Our truck was late, but we decided to hire the truck that Fox might hire the next day or CNN hire the day before. And that was very important because when our truck finally came, they pulled up on the grounds of the prison and the truck drivers pulled down the window and they said, "Miss Goodman, where do you want the truck?" So I said, "Well, actually, the prison guards are saying you have to." They said, "Where do you want the truck?" So I said, "Well, actually, I would like it right next to the protest pen." And they drove that truck right up to the protest pen. And as they got out, they were sort of kind of like those Oshkosh prison guards. They were big, bigger than the prison guards in Jackson. And as the guards came over to stop them, they took out their cameras. They handed me the microphone. They said, "Where do you want to stand?" And I'm looking at the guards backing off. I said, "I'll stand right at the rope, please." And we began our broadcast, not knowing what would happen. But if you're going to broadcast with big boys, you got to do it just like them. Now, why didn't the major networks protest? Why didn't they come over? They didn't really need to. I mean, for us, we were going to be broadcasting for hours. You know, what do you get from an 8 or 9 second soundbite, the standard size of a soundbite in the United States? You get the conventional wisdom. You can't get anything beyond that. But if you want someone to express a different point of view, they have to be able to explain what others haven't heard before, or they'll just sound crazy. And that's why so much of mainstream news marginalizes those who have another way of looking at the world. And I think especially for young people, why we play so many speeches is I think it's important for young people to see how someone arrives at a different conclusion, goes from A to B to C to Z. What's that journey they take? And you know, despite what the networks say, young people don't have an attention span. I think that is completely wrong. I think young people care about authenticity. I think they sense the sham. And when they hear people speaking from their hearts and from their heads, everyone listens. And we have to provide that opportunity. I'm just reading from the column we wrote that week. Dennis Moynihan and I write a column, and Dennis makes all of these tours possible. But Dennis and I have written two books together, our weekly columns, Breaking the Sound Barrier, and the latest is The Silenced Majority. And the reason we call it The Silenced Majority is because I really do think that those who are concerned about war and peace, about the growing economic disparity in our country, those who are concerned about climate change, the fate of the planet, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why it's so beautiful to be here with KUNM and KSFR and New Mexico Public Television here at the LUNSEC. So back to that night, September 21st, as we stood there, the prison guards and the PR for the prison gave us a press packet for the journalists. It was actually very thin. It explained a few things. It explained how Troy Davis would spend his last day. And it said that at 3 p.m., his family and friends would be cleared out from seeing him because he would have to undergo a routine physical. A routine physical? You know what happened recently in Texas when a man was about to be executed? He attempted suicide. They raced him to the hospital. He got better, and then they executed him. This is the protocol, and it's very important to report on this. Davis had turned down the special meal. You know, in this country, a prisoner on death row can eat anything he or she wants as their last meal. But Davis said no. So the press kit described the standard fare that he would be served. It went into great detail. It said he would be offered grilled cheeseburgers, oven-browned potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw, cookies, and a grape beverage. Then it gave us, there was another page in the press packet, and it just had four lines on it. It was the lethal cocktail that would follow. The first line, pentobarbital, then pancuronium bromide, then potassium chloride, then Ativan, in parentheses, a sedative. The pentobarbital anesthetizes, the pancuronium bromide paralyzes, the potassium chloride stops the heart. The only things Davis could exert his will over, the Last Supper and the sedative, he said no to. By 7 p.m., the U.S. Supreme Court was reportedly reviewing Davis's plea for a stay. The case was referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who hails from Pinpoint, Georgia, a community founded by freed slaves that's near Savannah, where Davis had lived. The chorus for clemency grew louder. Alan Ault, the former warden of Georgia's death row prison in Jackson, who oversaw 5 executions there, sent a letter to Georgia Governor Nathan Deal, co-signed by 5 other retired wardens or directors of state prisons. They wrote, "While most of the prisoners whose executions we participated in accepted responsibility for the crimes for which they were punished, some of us have also executed prisoners who maintained their innocence until the end. It is those cases that are most haunting to an executioner." The Supreme Court denied Troy Davis's plea. Davis's execution began at 10:53 p.m. A prison spokesperson delivered the news to the reporters outside. Time of death, 11:08 p.m. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. You know the protocol in an execution. The murder victim has family members there to witness the execution of the convicted prisoner. The convicted prisoner may or may not get his or her choice for people there. And then there are the reporters. The prisoner is brought out, laid out on a cross-like gurney, strapped down, and then the curtains are pulled back, and through the window, they see the audience. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. According to an Associated Press reporter who was there, these were Troy Davis's final words. He said, "I'd like to address the McPhail family. Let you know I'm not the one who killed your son, your father, your brother. I am innocent. The incident that happened that night is not my fault. I did not have a gun. All I can ask is that you look deeper into the case so that you really can finally see the truth. I ask my family and friends to continue to fight this fight." And then he turned to his executioners. And he said, "For those about to take my life, God have mercy on your souls. God bless your souls." The state of Georgia took Davis's body to Atlanta for an autopsy, charging his family for the transportation. On Troy Davis's death certificate, the cause of death is listed simply as homicide. As we stood on the grounds of the prison, it was just before midnight, just after Troy Davis was executed. The Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast. The show was over. I was reminded what Gandhi reportedly answered when asked what he thought of Western civilization. He said, "I think it would be a good idea." That was another of the movements that fueled Occupy Wall Street. The media in New York hardly covered the first week of Occupy, despite the fact it's the media metropolis of the world. And then I remember Erin Burnett on CNN a week later, as she was just starting her show called Out Front, I think it's called. And her first show, she talked about the night before on a media criticism show, she was going to go out to talk to the people in every country, all over, to really find out what was happening on the ground. Her first show was her special segment. She went to Occupy Wall Street, and the segment was headlined, "Seriously?" So you either got no coverage, or the protesters were mocked. What do they represent? They are holding signs on every different issue. You've got the people opposed to the death penalty. You've got the people who are concerned about climate change. And then there are the ones who care about economic disparity. What do these people want? Can't they make up their minds? And I thought, really? Isn't this the power of this movement? I mean, even though the police eviscerated the encampments in a coordinated move all over the country, and you know, the conversations were documented of the police chiefs in many different cities to figure out what to do. But even though the encampments were wiped out, how can one possibly say this movement was meaningless? Right now, if you say the word 99%, everyone knows what you are talking about. If you say the word 1%, everyone knows what you are referring to. And there are those in the 1% that completely agree with the concerns of the 99%. We mustn't caricature anything, but we all have a different vocabulary to describe the concern of people in this country that links all of these different movements. That was the power of Occupy Wall Street, of Occupy Louisville, of Occupy Oakland, people expressing concern at the direction of the country. Now, I wanted to talk about President Obama's election, the first election in 2008, and what it meant and where we are today, 5-6 years later. I mean, I think that the world heaved a sigh of relief the night that he was elected. I mean, for so long, people felt they'd hit their head against a brick wall. The wall had become a door. The door opened a crack. The question was, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? You think about all the movements that coalesced around President Obama's election. They felt they had accomplished the impossible. I mean, one issue alone, the fact that an African-American president had been elected in a land with a legacy of slavery, was astounding in itself, let alone those who were concerned about war, having a candidate they felt might end the war, at least in Iraq. One of his first executive orders was to close Guantanamo within a year. Could this be happening? His concern expressed about immigrants, and yet Guantanamo is not closed. We are about to hit a remarkably awful landmark. In the next week or two, 2 million immigrants will have been deported from this country. We've never seen anything like this under any president in history. Even the establishment immigrant groups like La Raza that have steadfastly backed President Obama, pointing the finger at the Republicans, saying they're stopping meaningful immigration reform, this past week called President Obama the deporter in chief. On all of these different levels, the new normal for President Obama, increasing drone strikes, the thousands of people, not only President Obama's administration, but before as well, the thousands of innocents who have been killed in these drone strikes. How many of you have seen Jeremy Scahill and Rick Rowley's remarkable film, Dirty Wars? I mean, to see them on the red carpet at the Oscars was truly astounding. That their documentary was chosen as one of five to compete, that 1 billion people heard about just that phrase, dirty wars. The story of the nighttime raids, of the increasing drone strikes. How could drone strikes possibly increase our national security? When you have so many innocents, wedding convoy in Yemen, another one in Afghanistan that is blown up, you have a young reporter in Yemen comes to testify before Congress, said, I was a high school student in the southwest of the United States. I would come home to my village, tell the amazing stories of the United States, how we must befriend them. And he says, and then my village is hit. And then you have the story of Karim Khan. If you're a regular listener or viewer of Democracy Now!, you know the story because of the remarkable documentary done by a young reporter, Pakistani-American, named Madiha Tahir. I was with her at Columbia J School just 2 nights ago to show her film, Wounds of Waziristan. She went home. She was the first one to tell the stories of the people on the ground, talking about drone strikes, like Karim Khan, who is a freelance reporter. His brother and his son were killed in a drone strike in 2009, and he said, why? And just a few weeks ago, as he was about to testify before the European Parliament to stop supporting the drone strikes, He was pulled out of his home. His family saw, his neighbors saw, by men in uniform and not in uniform, and he was disappeared. People were terrified. There was a global campaign to have him released. His lawyer is named Shehzad Akbar, a Pakistani lawyer who is representing these drone strike victims, who, when a family of his clients just a few months ago came to testify before Congress, his clients being Zuhair, a 13-year-old boy, and Nabila, his 9-year-old sister, who were out picking Oprah with their 68-year-old grandma, and she was eviscerated in a drone strike. They came to testify before Congress. How often do we hear people speaking in their own words at the target end of U.S. foreign policy? And their lawyer was going to accompany them. More than a lawyer, he spoke English. He would be their translator. He would be the man who protected them in the place they were coming, which was the original place of that drone. He was denied a visa. I don't know if the U.S. government thought this family would never come by themselves, but they did. Their father, Rafiq Rahman, whose mother was the one who was killed, and his little boy and girl came to Washington, then came to New York, and appeared on Democracy Now! And I'll never forget the 13-year-old boy saying, when I asked him, tell me about your grandmother, he said, I feel funny saying my grandmother. You see, she was the grandmother of our whole village. How do you think that makes his whole village feel? And then he said, we are afraid when it's a blue sky day because, he said, when it's overcast, there will be no drones. But when the day is clear, then we hear the buzzing overhead. And his little sister, 9 years old, showed us the scars. She has had repeated operations as a result of also suffering injuries from these drone strikes. Stanford University and New York University put out a remarkable report called Living Under the Drones, talking about the numbers of people who have been killed. How critical is it that we have these remarkably brave young reporters like Jeremy Scahill, who goes to Somalia, who goes to Yemen, who goes to Afghanistan, to report those stories that the U.S. government doesn't want you to know about? And how important is it that you have whistleblowers who work for the government, deeply believing in our government? Oh, someone like Edward Snowden. Who, you know that Edward Snowden, well, one of the chief whistleblowers in this country today, though outside this country, he, after September 11th, wanted to be in the special forces. Problem is, in training, he broke both his legs. And then he goes to work for as a contractor for National Security Agency, and he says, oh, my God, I realized, I mean, here's this kid who didn't even graduate from high school. I'll never forget when I saw Congress members saying, who is he? This guy who didn't even graduate, to be telling us that he can read President Obama's email. I thought it was the opposite. This kid who doesn't even graduate is able to read the email of President Obama. And of course, the Obama administration, James Clapper, head of national intelligence, goes before Congress, says all of this is a lie. And of course, he was lying. But that proved why Snowden, it wasn't enough for him just to say, trust me on this, I've seen the documents. He had to have the documents in hand. It was the only way the Obama administration was forced to admit some of what he was saying was true. And he felt he had to leave this country. It was quite something recently to read the New York Times editorial saying, now I guess we do have to say that Edward Snowden is a whistleblower. But think about the global conversation that we are now having. I mean, the profound words of Snowden now in Russia saying, I'm not trying to push social change. He said, that's not up to me. I just wanted to provide the information that people in the United States could decide if they want change. Have we made a decision about this increasing national surveillance state? It is astounding what has taken place. Whether the corporations are witting collaborators or not, I think we haven't gotten to the bottom of that. But the fact that the government is using these corporations to spy on all of us, and we don't even know a hundredth of the extent to this. And I think about a documentary that just came out from Dawn Porter, Spies of Mississippi, talking about the Sovereignty Commission in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s in Mississippi. White and black spies that were paid by the Mississippi government to subvert the civil rights movement, the racist Sovereignty Commission. They just didn't have the advanced technology that the state does today. But they were doing the very same thing, spying on Americans, subverting them. We certainly know the war against the Black Panthers. It wasn't only spying, infiltrating. Terrible violence was used against them, the killing of the Black Panthers, Mark Clark, and Mark Clark, as well as Fred Hampton. Thank you very much to the author of the book about Fred Hampton. We can look back in history and see what happened in this country. Sometimes you think how far we have come, but then you realize how far we have to go. So you look at what President Obama has accomplished and hasn't accomplished, and you wonder, how did that happen when people held out so much promise? Well, I think two things. One thing is people were exhausted after he was elected. They couldn't believe what they'd accomplished across every movement. And then they didn't want to contribute to the racist backlash like the birther movement saying, you know, how could this man be from the United States? They didn't want to participate in any of that. And so people stepped back. What happens when the community organizer-in-chief, he was a community organizer, becomes the commander-in-chief? Who becomes the community organizers then? How do you push for the very demands you push for the day before the election? You know, when people ask, do you think President Obama will accomplish this, or do you think he'll stop this from happening? It's not about this one person in the White House. He may be the most powerful person on earth. But when he sits in the Oval Office, when those who are used to having the ear of the most powerful person on earth whisper in it and make their demands, if he can't point out the window and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille, if no one's out there, he's in big trouble. And that's when he agrees with you. What about when you don't agree with him? How are you going to express your concerns? You don't achieve democracy. You fight for it.